You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to Tea Break Time Travel, where every month we look at a different archaeological object and take you on a journey into their past.
Hello and welcome to episode 29 of Tea Break Time Travel. I'm your host, Dr. Matilda Siebrecht. That's right, I'm adding the doctor in there. I thought, why not? I've worked enough for it. Let's add it in there. And today I am savouring a tea called Heaven's Fruit, which is lovely and sweet and fruity. And there is no guest with me today because it's time for our next instalment of Tea Break Time Travel Training, where we're going to look at all of those theoretical and methodological backgrounds that every seasoned time traveler and archaeologist needs to know before they set off on their journey. So today we're continuing with our theme of dating, and I mean by that, checking how old something is, and we're going to be talking about dendrochronology. So, what is dendrochronology? Well, you might know it more as tree ring dating. So basically using the rings that are created on the inside of trees to date. But how does that actually work in practice? Well, to find that out, we need to think, actually, how do tree rings form? So in episode 27, we revisited high school chemistry and physics class. This episode, we're going back to biology class. So, let me get my biology textbook out and have a look. How do tree rings form? So the first thing that you need to know about is something called the vascular cambium. What is the vascular cambium? Well, this is a ring of growth tissue that basically sits in between the sapwood, which is the very, very central part of the tree, and the inner bark. So not the outer bark, not the hard bit you can see, but the kind of inner layer of that bark. And the cambium, the vascular cambium, is responsible for the creation of xylem and phloem cells. And if you remember back from biology, xylem cells are in the sapwood, right in the middle central part of the tree, and they transport all of the water and the soluble nutrients up the tree. And so basically up to the leaves, kind of really simplifying. And then the phloem cells, they're in the inner bark, and they transport the sap, which contains sugar, around the tree and specifically down to the roots. So very important for the growth of the tree. And when the cambium layer is active, that means that there's a lot of cell division taking place. And if you remember anything from biology, you hopefully remember cell division, which means that you basically create a lot more cells. Cells divide, make more cells. So the creation of more material, the creation of more stuff. So basically, in very simple forms, adding a new layer of wood around the edge of the tree underneath the bark. So that's when it's active. So how do the rings themselves actually then form? So in winter, the cambium is inactive. It's sleeping. It's very cold. I can understand. But in spring, things start to warm up a bit and you get a real sudden spurt of activity in the cambium layer. And this leads to a relatively quick growth of new cells, lots and lots of cell division going on. So you add that new layer of cells to the tree, which means you basically expand the width of the tree. And when we see this kind of growth, this wood in the tree rings, we call it early wood. Now, get your mind out of the gutter. I am talking about wood, the tree, the material that trees are made of. So at this time of the growing season, in the spring, when it's starting to warm up, the bulk of the sugars that are being used are coming from stored reserves that have been kind of left in the roots, for example, or elsewhere in the tree. So this means that in order to save on that sugar and not to use up all of the reserves, the cell walls are quite thin. What does that mean? This means that the cells look paler or lighter because they don't have this thick wall. So that means that the wood that is created is also a lot lighter. However, in the summer, towards the end of the summer especially, the leaves of the tree are completely formed. Photosynthesis is in full swing, creates lots and lots of sugars. The cell walls begin to get a lot thicker due to this abundance of sugars. And this, therefore, makes a little bit of a darker color. So you then start to see dark wood being formed in the cambium layer in this new tree ring. And that color is known as late wood. And then towards the end of the summer, of course, it starts to get colder. You enter fall, it becomes very, very dark. And then winter comes, the cambium's inactive again. So that's what you're seeing in the tree ring. You're seeing this early wood and late wood formation. And that's creating what is essentially then a ring, this light to dark wood that we're seeing. Now, I know what you're thinking. Okay, fine. You have early spring, late summer, but surely that's all very dependent then on how warm it is. That's very dependent on the climate. That's very, very dependent on external circumstances. How on earth can you be absolutely sure and use that to date each time, because it might be a very hot winter or it might be a very cold summer. So surely tree ring growth is irregular. And yes, that is absolutely true. So it doesn't always necessarily correspond to an actual calendar year. It's not like we can say, right, this tree ring goes from the 1st of April 2023 to the 1st of April 2024. But that's actually to our advantage, because what we do is then we use these fluctuations, we use these sort of differences in the tree ring thickness, the tree ring color, whatever other kind of characteristics, to match them up with each other. And that creates a timeline. So what you do, you have this thing that's known as a long chronology. And so the real core of dendrochronology is this long chronology, which is basically a timeline that you make by matching up lots of overlapping sets of matched rings. And the reason that you can match them up so nicely is because of this irregularity, because of these fluctuations. So you can see, for example, on this tree that's, say, I don't know, from 1990 to 1995, you can see this particular pattern of tree rings. Then you have another tree, which is maybe from 1992 to 1999. And you can find that exact same pattern in the tree rings because it was in the same environment. You can find that same pattern in the tree rings, so you can match them up, but then you have an overlap. Then you have another level that you can see, another step, shall we say, in the timeline. So then you find another tree that's even older or younger, and you can use that. And this is basically the long chronology. It's loads and loads of steps of overlapping tree rings that you can go back hundreds, thousands even, of years. So that's basically what dendrochronology is. But how did it actually come about? Because we all know about tree rings, right? We all know that you can count the years of a tree, even though we've just shown actually that's probably slightly inaccurate. But how did we start to look at that and date archaeological sites? Well, it's all thanks to a man called Andrew Ellicott Douglas. And Andrew Ellicott Douglas was an astronomer, and he became interested in the cycle of sunspots and to see whether these kind of solar cycles had any kind of effect on the environmental conditions of Earth. So whether they caused big environmental issues such as drought, etc. But something that he soon noticed when he wanted to look at this, and he wanted to look at the history then of these environmental conditions, he realized that, of course, he didn't have access to past weather reports from, you know, hundreds or even thousands of years ago. So he didn't know how to look at those different fluctuations and to correlate that with solar activity in the past. But then he had an idea. Haha. Previous scientists have shown already that this kind of tree ring growth happens on an annual basis and can be affected by environmental fluctuations of some sort. So therefore, maybe by looking at the pine trees that grew in this sort of local area that he was interested in, maybe you looked at the pattern of their growth layers and you can see through that a kind of record of things like droughts or very wet periods that stretched back for centuries. And you could use this record in place of the weather record. So you could kind of infer a different environmental activity based on the pattern of the growth layers, aka the tree rings. And it turned out you absolutely could. So he was very happy with this result. He went on, he wrote about it, he presented it. And during one of these presentations at a conference, there were some archaeologists in the audience who were having trouble dating, as in finding out how old, their prehistoric site was. They were trying to do it through kind of typologies, through all sorts of other ways, but they were really struggling to be able to work out a nice, accurate way of dating exactly how old these sites were. So then they saw this really interesting study by Douglas. So somewhere between sort of 1910 to 1920, it's unsure exactly when the collaboration started, but Douglas began to collaborate with the American Museum of Natural History, in particular a man called Clark Whistler, who was an anthropologist, an archaeologist, and an ethnographer, who, interestingly enough, slight side rabbit hole, was one of the first people to define an archaeological culture. So there you go. That's Clark Whistler. And so this collaboration was to see whether using this kind of tree ring dating method, tree ring chronology that he'd created, he could accurately determine the age of prehistoric sites in the American Southwest. And there were many years of losing funding, scraping together other projects, lots of different experiments, creating a big reference collection. And it was found that actually, indeed, he could do these things and he could give a relatively accurate date for these sites. And so in 1937, Douglas founded the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona. And since then, there have been lots and lots of different tree ring labs founded all over the world. We're expanding the reference collection to incorporate, of course, other environmental areas, other parts of the world, other regions, other species, because he started with the pines, but that's now been expanded out because, of course, trees will grow at different rates depending on the species, depending on their environment, etc. But actually, what I find really great is that this method that he had was just so accurate and also just so ridiculously simple, this kind of step system of just basically identifying patterns and matching them up in an overlapping step system, that first record, that sort of pine record that was created by Douglas back in the early 1900s, is still used as a reference for dendrochronologists in that region today. So I think that that's pretty astounding. And actually, fun fact, you use dendrochronology quite a lot to calibrate, i.e. to sort of correct or double check the dates that you get using radiocarbon dating. So if you want to find out more about radiocarbon dating, make sure to check last month's training episode, episode 27, for all more information. So that's the kind of basic history and sort of all of how it works in terms of dendrochronology. So let's quickly top up our tea and then we can get stuck into the details of how dendrochronology actually works in practice and, more importantly, what its issues are. Welcome back, everyone. Hope you're enjoying that delicious cup of tea. So we've had a bit of an introduction to the kind of principles and the basics of dendrochronology, the history of dendrochronological research, but how does it actually work in practice? So basically, you take a cross-section of the tree or of the wood artifact or object that you're trying to get the date of. If that's not possible, say, for example, the trees that you need to compare with are still very alive, very important, the object you're looking at can't have kind of a cross-section cut out of it, it's actually quite common now to take a core, which is still invasive, but shouldn't technically be as harmful. And you don't actually need that big of a core to be able to, just enough to be able to identify the tree rings. And when you're taking this sample, you really need as clean a sample as possible. So preferably you should have both the sapwood and the bark. You should avoid things like knots and cracks, which will then, of course, kind of distort the growth of tree rings. So there's actually some really interesting papers looking at where in relation to the tree rings and the tree ring growth you should actually take your sample from, because some angles are much better than others in terms of seeing the rings, but then some angles you'll miss the bark or miss the sapwood. So yeah, in ensuring that you get as big a picture as possible, basically. So then you have your sample, you smooth it out, you sand it very, very smooth, you prepare it so that the rings are as clear as possible, and then you compare that against other tree ring samples with an overlapping age. And you have built them up step by step to build this chronology, you end up with this kind of graph with lots of squiggly lines on it. And basically, you want to find the squiggle that best looks like the squiggle that your graph has. So to put it very, very, very simply. So it really is just looking at patterns and just looking at kind of how these fluctuations fit with other patterns. So that's all that you're looking at, really. So what you need, of course, is a good reference collection, a good reference sample collection. So as I mentioned before, the reference collection that Douglas had created was for the pines in America. And now there's all sorts of different references for all kinds of different species in all kinds of different regions. So it's growing and growing every day. And what's important, though, is that you don't just use dendrochronology to look at how old something is, to look how far back these rings were created. You can also, as Douglas was originally doing in his original research, right, you can see different environmental events in the past. So you can use wooden objects or wooden artifacts, even if you don't have trees from that time, to look at something that happened in the past environmentally. So for example, the width of the tree changes, right, depending on how well the tree grew that year, which is affected by environmental impacts. If it's warmer, it affects it. If it's colder, if it's wetter, if it's drier. And what's really interesting, for me at least, was that studies have shown that a tree will react pretty much immediately to an event. So you know that as soon as you see something happening in that tree ring, that was also when it was kind of happening in real life. So I feel like I should talk more about dendrochronology in practice, but I mean, it's really weirdly simple. Like you literally just, you take a cross section or a core and you look at the tree rings and you match them up with other tree rings, and going back and back and back, you can see, okay, well, this wood was chopped down at this point. But that, however, is something to consider. So similar to what we mentioned last time with radiocarbon dating, you have to make sure that you actually understand what it is you're dating by this dendrochronological method. So you're looking at when this tree was cut down so it could no longer grow new tree rings. So actually, all you're really doing is seeing when the tree was cut down, which mostly it's assumed, okay, well, this tree was cut down at this point. Therefore, we assume it was used to build this house, to carve into this artifact, to build this piece of furniture, to make this cart, to make this wheel, whatever it is you're looking at. We assume that it was done fairly soon after the cutting down process. But this is something you have to keep in mind, because it might be that actually it was cut down and then hung around for 100 years and then was made into something. So you really need to make sure you understand the context of what you're seeing. But something that is probably one of the biggest issues is the availability of a reference collection and how much of an impact that has on the analysis. So there was a really good quote that I found, which I have also put the source for, which is that the fundamental principle of tree ring based dendroprovenancing, so basically working out where the wood came from, is that trees growing in the same area will be affected by the same environmental factors and therefore will produce similar tree ring patterns. And this is pretty much key to dendrochronological research as well. So not only in terms of looking, where does this wood come from? Well, we can find other wood with similar patterns and that's where it came from. But also understanding that in order to look at the chronology, in order to have these comparable pieces that you can refer your archaeological pieces against, you need to make sure that they're from the same region. That not even, I mean, because trees are so sensitive to change, the vegetation or the growth rate is so strongly affected by all the external factors. So you get a difference in growth rate between trees, the same species of tree, but in different hemispheres, in different continents, in different parts of the same continent, in different elevations within that same part of the same continent. So you really have to make sure that you have a valid reference from the same region and environmental conditions, because otherwise you won't find any kind of recognizable pattern. And based on this as well, we spoke in the last training episode a little bit about how industrialization affected the accuracy of radiocarbon dating, right? Because you suddenly had a ton more carbon being released into the air with all of the nuclear testing going on. And while, I mean, technically, modern human activity doesn't necessarily affect the dating part of dendrochronology, right? Because even if you have some climatic events or some environmental global warming, other forms of climate change, you'll see that in the rings and you'll still have that pattern and you'll still have that reference. And that's all that's important. So it doesn't affect that, but it does potentially affect our understanding of the environmental activity that we get from these tree rings. So usually you can look and see, okay, this species is growing this much in that year. That means that it must have been this temperature and it was this kind of weather and it was this hot and it was this wet, etc., because you have that reference collection from past years where you can see, okay, in this year it was this dry, this hot, this wet, and this tree grew this much. Therefore, we know the same thing for this other tree must have been the case. Or, you know, something to that effect. I mean, that sounds very simplistic, but something to that effect. However, it seems that there's quite a lot of species, especially in higher elevations, it seems, that have altered their sensitivity to these climate trends in the last century, perhaps due to the extra stress of global warming. So this means that the tree rings that they create now are no longer comparable in terms of identifying those particular temperatures or those other environmental impacts, because the trees are responding differently now to those same temperatures or environmental impacts than they did 100 years ago. This is what's known as the divergence problem. And like I say, while at the moment it doesn't seem to affect tree ring dating because you can still compare the tree rings, even if they're different to the older tree rings, it's something to keep an eye on because maybe in the future it might have an effect and it might be something that we have to keep in mind. And then the final kind of points that I want to go through is not so much an issue, although it will turn into a bit of an issue, but it's something that I find really fascinating is the attempt to digitalize the process of dendrochronological analysis. So people have come up with all kinds of programs and tools. There's some really interesting papers out there. But at the end of the day, it seems that nothing can truly compare, or at least nothing can improve on the human eye in finding and linking patterns in these multiple tree ring maps, because you have to have a little bit of interpretation, a little bit of imagination as well, which I find really fascinating. Although on the other side of that, this means that there is indeed an issue just with the field of dendrochronology in general, because if you don't have people who are specialized in recognizing those patterns and who have that experience, then you'll lose that knowledge. So similar to many, I guess, traditional crafts that are sort of dying out all over the world, archaeology would face a really big problem if dendrochronologists and their physical reference samples, more specifically as well, are no longer available to consult. So this might just be through, you know, people retiring, through a tree ring lab shutting down, through, you know, death, through leaving the field in other ways, through fires or disasters at university that destroy the collections, or through maybe the university not realizing the importance of the samples and disposing of them, which has apparently happened in the past. So because it's so reliant, the field of dendrochronology is so reliant on comparisons and samples and know-how, it's actually quite a fragile discipline. So if anyone's listening in and thinking, hey, I really love archaeological science, I wonder which direction I should go in, maybe specialize in dendrochronology, because there's definitely the need to have a good selection of people and samples and references in order to keep this discipline alive, because it is one of the most accurate dating methods, really, especially for as long as we have dealt with wood and for as long as we have chopped down wood and used it as a regular material in our buildings. And yeah, that's how long we can date, basically, which I think is really quite fascinating. So that was my little brief introduction to dendrochronology. Hope you enjoyed it. Do keep an eye out for this month's guest episode, which will feature Raven Todd da Silva, and we'll look at the giant colossal heads from the Olmec culture in Mesoamerica. So keep an eye out for that one in 2 weeks. I hope that you enjoyed our training session today. If you want to help support this show, please do like, subscribe, follow wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to support all of the other amazing series that form the Archaeology Podcast Network, you can become a member. You will help us to create even more amazing content, and we'll also have exclusive access to ad-free episodes and bonus content. For example, our online series looking at different topics within archaeology, or our read-alongs such as that for And My Trowel, which looked at a fantastical analysis, archaeological analysis of The Hobbit. So for more information on membership or any other ways that you can support the APN, make sure to check out our homepage, archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If you did, make sure to like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.